Source is a podcast made by women for women. We talk with a wide variety of experts, ranging from a sex therapist to the CDC and everywhere in between, to bring you the stories you're only going to hear here. Our goal is to entertain and educate, because it's more clear now than ever just how much we as women are doing as parents, as spouses, employees, just as everything. Don't miss out on being in the know. Subscribe to Soul Source wherever you listen to podcasts today. Leave us a review too, because this part's really important. When you leave those reviews, that's how we're able to continue bringing you the content you love each and every week. So buckle up, Soul Source Society, because we're about to get started.
It's not your fault. Don't blame yourself. All the responsibility, all the guilt and the shame lies squarely on your abuser. End of story.
Hello there. I am your host of Soul Source, Raquel Lamel, and today I'm talking to a woman who has a powerful story to share with us about overcoming sexual abuse in a place where we are all taught to feel safe and to trust the people who are there. Sandy Kirkham is the author of the book, Let Me Pray Upon You. It's a memoir of her life as a teen who was abused by her youth pastor. After years of shame and hiding, Sandy's finally come out with her story, and she's speaking publicly about it, helping others who are victims of clergy abuse. Sandy, I want to thank you for being here on Soul Source today and sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So start off at the beginning. What happened? How old were you when this started?
Well, I think the beginning really needs to start before the actual abuse. It's important to understand how important church was to me and how involved I was in the church. I began attending when I was 8. My parents didn't go to church, but I was invited by my friend up the street, and I just fell in love with it. My parents were divorced, so I didn't see my dad much, and I was kind of in a place of uncertainty in my life, and so church provided this secure place. It was a happy place for me. I absolutely loved everything about the church. As I got older, I started teaching Sunday school. I sang in the choir. I was very involved in the church, and I looked up to the adults, and I think they looked up to me as well, in as active as I was in the church. I was baptized when I was 13, and from that point on, my spiritual life really deepened, and it became really my entire life. Shortly after I turned 16, our church hired a new youth pastor, and he was very different than any youth pastor we'd ever seen. He was 30 and married with 2 children, but he was really more like the teenagers. He dressed like we did. He drove an orange convertible. And, you know, he was just kind of like you'd say in the 70s, hip. And so he was also very charismatic. His sermons were dynamic. There was just an aura about him, and people were drawn to him. He took our youth group from like 25 kids over to 100 in a very short time.
Wow. Okay.
So he was very dynamic, and everyone loved this man, and they loved what he was doing in our church. It was at a youth group meeting that was held at my home. After everyone left, he waited for everyone to be gone, and then he stopped me in my hallway, and he told me how wonderful I was and how much he appreciated all I had been doing. He had really tapped into me as to be one of the leaders, and so I was spending a lot of time with him and working on projects with him. All, you know, very innocent in my mind. This was all just a way of helping the church grow. Mm-hmm. But that night, when he stopped me in my hallway after telling me how wonderful I was, he bent down and he kissed me. And it wasn't really, it was kind of like a quick, innocent kiss, but it was a kiss. And I remember thinking, I think he just kissed me. But I was so taken aback, and I kept thinking, this is my youth pastor. You know, he wouldn't do anything he shouldn't be doing. So, you know, maybe this is just his way of showing me how much he appreciates me. And he was very just demonstrative in his ways with people. He was always hugging people. He was always telling them that he loved them and how much he appreciated them. So the only way I could really justify it was the fact that this was just a quick kiss that he meant to say how much he appreciated me, because that's the only way I could figure out what was really going on. But I babysat for his family. His wife worked evenings, and so this gave him the perfect opportunity to spend a lot of time with me in the evenings. He wouldn't take me home right away after the children were in bed. We'd sit and talk about the Bible. We'd talk about how we could get church to grow and just things that seemed normal that you would talk to about your pastor. Mm-hmm. And kissing became more frequent. The hugging became more intense. And that took about a year until he finally got to his ultimate goal, which was to have sex with me, which he did.
Oh my goodness. Now I can only imagine, like, this is something that you're probably, you said you were taken aback a little bit, and I'm sure it was. Did you realize what was happening as this was going on?
Well, not with the kissing and the hugging. I kind of justified that. I mean, I just accepted it. And I liked the attention. I mean, he was giving me special attention that I knew probably every other girl and every woman in that church would have loved to have had. And he wasn't crossing the line any other way. So that I kind of accepted. But once that night that he took me to his bedroom and had sex with me, I knew that was wrong. And I knew that we'd crossed the line. And then he made sure that I was to never tell anyone, that if I were to tell anyone, I would be responsible for what would happen. And honestly, I didn't think I wanted anyone to know this about me, that I had just had sex with the pastor. So it was kind of a protection for me to not to tell anyone as well. And I didn't see it as abuse. He was telling me that he loved me and that he needed me and that what he was able to do in the ministry was because of me. He started misusing scripture, saying that this was God's will. And, you know, I'm 17 years old. I've trusted this man up to this point. And I didn't know else to do but to keep it a secret.
Okay, so how long was this going on for?
Well, the grooming process, which I call that year that he just was setting me up, that was about a year. And then after he had sex with me, that went on for another 4 years. And once he had sex with me, his personality totally changed. I was no longer perfect. I was no longer good enough. I wasn't smart enough. He always was worried that I weighed too much and I was too fat. I mean, he became very critical of me. He became very possessive. He started to isolate me from my friends. He began to tell me how to dress, what I was to do. He eventually became physical, which then really set me on a different pattern of how I behaved, because I just knew that, you know, if I didn't do what he told me to do, then I could be the result of being abused physically by him.
Oh my goodness. So it starts, you're underage, you're a minor, but by the time he was caught, correct?
Correct.
So you're an adult by the time that happens?
I was probably 21. Yes, I was 21.
Okay. So, I mean, how did that happen? How did he ultimately, when did this all come to an end or to a head, I guess?
So this went on for 5 years. And as you can imagine, you know, people are beginning to notice things, but they kind of just ignored any red flags they might have seen because he was the pastor and just assumed that, you know, he wouldn't be doing anything he shouldn't be doing. But there were a couple of the elders that became suspicious. So they followed him one night and they found us together in a hotel room. He was taken by the elders that evening back to the church. His wife was informed. And then from that point on, the goal really became to find a way to keep this secretive and move him to the next church. I was told by the elders where I was to sit in church, how I was to behave. If I was asked any questions, I was to go to the elders. I wasn't to answer any questions. I was even told not to tell my parents. And I agreed to all of that because I was like a puppet with these people. I didn't know what else to do. And at this point, again, I had accepted the relationship and I had fallen into believing all of his lies, that this was God's will. And at one point I remember thinking, I'm never going to get out of this relationship until he says it's over. And so there was somewhat, I was protecting him as well. So when they would tell me, you know, you've got to do this because if we don't, people are going to find out and then he can't go to the next church. It took about 3 months to get him finally moved to the next church, and which they did. He was moved to the next church. And I was then called in by the elders and told that because of my behavior, I was to leave the church. And I was devastated. That was the only church I knew. I loved that church. It was my life. And to be told that I wasn't fit to worship there any longer was devastating to me. And it truly affected me for the next 27 years and how my spiritual life was damaged by the result of being told I was to leave the church.
And I mean, first off, that seems very double standard-ish. I mean, you talked about how it damaged your faith. Can you talk to me about, you know, how you just, like, what were your thoughts when he's being moved and allowed to continue working and you're being kicked out?
Well, I mean, didn't see this as abuse. I saw this as that I was an equal participant in this, and that I was having this affair, and that I should be punished as well. The difference was he wasn't being punished. I was the one being punished, but I accepted that because they blamed me. You know, they looked at me as someone who probably flirted with him, who trapped him. I don't know what they thought, because no one ever asked me any questions. No one talked to me. It was simply protecting him and what they could do to move him to the next church. And I don't defend that in any way, but to some extent, I can understand it in the sense that, you know, he was not dispensable. I was. He was someone that had baptized their children, who had married them. They had a relationship with him. And they saw him as this individual who had these great gifts, which he did. And they didn't want his pastor to be ruined. This pastor was so wonderful that it would be a shame to let this one mistake ruin his life. However, it wasn't just one mistake. Prior to coming to our church, a young woman for his first church came forward and accused him of inappropriate behavior. Our elders were aware of it. They confronted him. He said he was sorry, said he'd never do it again. And they allowed him to continue as our youth pastor, and no information was given to the congregation. And it was within that 6-month period, once he was confronted with the first accusation, that he was kissing me in my hallway. So they were aware that this was not the first incident of sexual misconduct.
I mean, you're a victim in this, right? You were underage when this started. And there's a lot of women who are victims of sexual abuse, whether it's clergy abuse or other forms of sexual abuse. Do you think, like what you just said, where everyone was blaming you, even though you were the victim, for causing this to happen, do you think that happens a lot for women and victims in general of sexual abuse?
Yes, I do. Because the first question is, well, why didn't you say no? Or why didn't you stop him? Or why didn't you tell someone? Those are all legitimate questions, but the answers are not as simple as people think. Well, you could have said no. When someone has been manipulating you and grooming you and setting you up, and it's someone that you trust, whether it's a family member or member of the clergy, you don't have the ability and the coping skills to be able to say no to this individual. Trauma, and it is a traumatic experience when someone touches you inappropriately or kisses you or does something they shouldn't be doing. The trauma almost freezes your brain to a point where you can't respond. You know, the psychologists have talked for years about the fight or flight reaction when you're confronted, but there's also the freeze reaction. And that's what most victims do. They freeze. They don't know how to respond. And when they don't respond, then they take on the guilt by thinking, well, I didn't tell him no, so it's just as much my fault for not stopping him. And again, because these are people that we're usually familiar with or someone we care about, and a lot of times people around us care about them and think they're wonderful, we don't want, I mean, I knew that if I were going to tell anyone, this would be a huge blow up in the church. This would destroy all these people's dreams and understanding of what was happening in the church. And I didn't want that responsibility. So there's a fear of telling. And I've kind of gone off track of what your original question was.
No, but this is good. You're right on track, actually. Keep going.
It's not as easy to say no. Because first of all, remember that these men, sometimes women, but these men target people who are vulnerable. They target people who have issues in their lives, because they know that they can get inside of this person and pretend to help them and to pretend to care about them in a way that no one else has understood them before or cared about them before. And this isn't just about children. This is adult women as well. Because when you're in a crisis mode as an adult woman, you aren't thinking clearly, and you're depending upon a person that you think you can trust to help you. And so the boundaries become a little blurred, because when this person starts saying things that you think might not be appropriate, you think, well, it's the pastor or it's the rabbi. So it's very difficult when you're in a situation emotionally challenged to be able to function clearly and to respond appropriately in a way that you would otherwise respond. And these men are very good at what they do. I mean, my abuser was very good at tapping into the fact that I didn't have my father very often in my life. So he became that father figure. And everything he would do for me and talk to me about my dad, or he would ask me what my issues were, he was so kind and so loving that I was being sucked in. And so when he began to kiss me. And when he went beyond that, you know, I just felt I even owed it to him to do this because he'd been so good to me. And maybe I did love him. I didn't know what love was, but he's telling me that he loves me. He's asking me, do you love me? And of course I loved him in a way that Christ would love the church but I was so confused. And that's what they do. They look for people who they know they can confuse easily and prey upon their vulnerabilities. I tell victims, this wasn't something that just happened to you. This was done to you. They targeted you. And they look for people who are vulnerable.
You said you didn't want to talk because you were afraid of ruining other people's lives. And you did. You kept this a secret for a long time. What made you finally start sharing your story?
So I didn't tell anyone about this for 27 years. There were some people in the church who knew and found out at the time. But for 27 years, I lived my life fearing that someone would find out about what I had done. And it's very difficult to live with a secret and guilt and shame for that length of time. And I honestly was going to go to my grave keeping this secret. But there was a trigger factor that forced me to face my past. That's in the first chapter of the book. I'm going to drive down to my daughter's golf tournament. It's in Tennessee. I live in Cincinnati, Ohio. It was a long trip. And I happened to pass the exit sign for the church that he went to after he left our church. And it sent a moment of anxiety. I was overwhelmed with grief. I was beginning to sob. I had to pull to the side of the road. I didn't know what was happening to me or why it was happening. But at that moment, it all came back to a point that I thought, this was not right what he did to me. And so at that point, I began the process of trying to figure out what actually had been done to me and how I was going to process it and where I was going to go from there, because I didn't know. Like I said, this was something I wasn't planning on doing, but I eventually confided in a very close friend. And with that, I slowly then began to tell a couple other friends. It would be a while before I would tell my husband, but I eventually did tell him. And that's what started this journey of healing. The main key was I began educating myself. I learned everything I could on clergy abuse. And then I began to see, yes, he groomed me. Yes, I saw the times that he manipulated times that we could be together that seemed innocent back then. He was gaslighting me, telling me that no one else was going to love me but him. He gaslighted me by telling me because I was no longer a virgin, no one else would love me. And and gaslighting is a point where they get you to believe the reality they want you to believe. And so I began to believe those things. I thought that I was unlovable and that no one else would care for me and that he was the only one. And so when I learned those terms of grooming, manipulation, and gaslighting, it became my aha moment. Yes, this is what he did to me. So it was education that really sent me on that path to be able to begin the healing process.
So as you've started sharing your story then and doing this educating of yourself, what are some of the things that you've learned about clergy abuse and the victims involved?
Well, I learned that clergy abuse, first of all, these men and sometimes women use the same tools and techniques. It's very common. It's almost like they read the same book. Again, they look for vulnerable people. They use the grooming process. They gaslight, they manipulate. And they also surround themselves with people that they've also manipulated and groomed, just like the congregation. He was like a rock star. I mean, and in a way, it was like a cult almost. You know, he would say to people, I want you to invite someone to church on Sunday. And he said it in a wonderful, loving, caring way. But you knew that you needed to invite someone to church on Sunday. I mean, that's the kind of culture they develop so that when they are discovered or caught, they have this kind of like a tribe around them who's willing to support them. So it's a very common MO that they all use. But education is the key in learning about how these men and women operate. And then the other thing I learned about clergy abuse, the devastation that it does to victims in their spiritual life. I mean, I knew what it did to mine, but so many victims, and I felt this way at the time, you think you're the only one. I mean, I didn't believe that this could have ever happened to anyone else. Even 27 years later, I still thought, you know, this is a rare occurrence. It's not. Sadly, it happens in every faith and every denomination. It's not just a Catholic issue. It, wherever there are vulnerable people and people who need help, which obviously the church is a place that we invite those people in, that's where you're going to find predators who will look for these people. So it's not just a Catholic issue. It really isn't just a church issue. It happens in the Boy Scouts. It happens, we've seen, with the gymnast in the U.S. gymnastics team. It happens where there are young people and vulnerable people. So those were the things that I learned about clergy abuse, that it's more common than we'd like to believe. And the response to how we deal with clergy abuse has been dealt with in the wrong ways.
Talk with me a little bit more about specifically with the clergy abuse piece of this and how it's different from other forms of sexual assault, because a church is a place you're taught is safe. You know, you're supposed to be able to feel safe. You're supposed to be able to trust, especially the pastors within the church. And as a child, I mean, I did a lot of church growing up. I went to several Lutheran churches actually as a child. And I mean, I know like the Sunday school and the pastor was somebody that you don't think twice, you know, you just openly trust them. So how is this different than just sexual abuse and other forms when it happens to you at a church setting?
Right. Well, as you said, we give them an automatic trust. We automatically assume that their actions and their words are going to be helpful and good for us. We don't question their motives. I tell people a lot of times, if you see something that the pastor is doing that you kind of get an uneasy feeling, would you accept that same behavior from your neighbor down the street? You know, just because he's the pastor doesn't mean that there can't be red flags. And when you see those red flags, you need to pay more attention. So yes, there's an automatic trust that goes with that. And then spiritually, because our spiritual lives are important to us, they really define who we are. We connect with others who have that same faith, and we share that faith with each other. It's important to us, and it's part of us. So when someone in a position who has authority, spiritual authority over us, betrays that trust, it contaminates everything about our spiritual life. It changes how we view God. It changes how we view church and how we view those around us who we thought would support us, and find that there is more support for the offending pastor than the actual victim. And even though my abuse happened 35 years ago now, I'm sad to say that many victims experience the same kind of response from churches. There's the effort to cover it up. They want to see this simply as a moral fall, that he made a mistake. That's not what's happened here. This is an individual who had a responsibility, an ethical and moral responsibility, to stay within the boundaries of his profession. And he chose not to. He chose to go out of those boundaries. It wasn't just a simple mistake. It's like any helping profession, whether you're a doctor, a teacher, a school counselor, a pastor. Once you agree to take on that role of helping another individual, it is always that professional's responsibility to stay within the boundaries. The person who has been abused by their power is not responsible. It is the sole responsible of the person in charge, who is to make sure that those boundaries are stayed within his confines of his profession. You know, a doctor having sex with his patient loses his license. I, as a nurse, if I'm caught stealing narcotics, I can no longer dispense medicine again. There is a boundary in every profession that's not to be crossed. And once it is, you lose that privilege to ever be in that position again. You have proven by your own actions that you've lost that privilege. Now, that's not to say that the church can't support that pastor, help him with counseling, and if they want, forgive him, but he's no longer fit to be a part of the ministry. He has proven that he's unfit for that. He basically is a wolf in sheep's clothing. And so I tell people, we want to give him a second chance. That's only a second chance to reoffend. I became a victim because my church decided, when they knew of the first incidents, that they were going to forgive him and give him a second chance. So we can't look at this as it's a mistake and we're going to return them to ministry. And I also say, if you're going to help pastor with counseling, you're going to give him support, you need to double that up with the victim and understand that the victim is not at fault in any way in this situation.
That is a perfect setup to what I want to ask you next, which is, do you think that the clergy system is broken? Because you just said doctors lose their license, nurses, you can't dispense medicine, but this pastor went to another church and then to another church. So do you think there's a broken system here? And if so, how?
Well, I think there's two things. One, my church and many churches, like independent churches, Evangelical Baptist Church of Christ, they don't have a hierarchy. So they can, in their own individual churches, make a decision whether or not to discipline an offending pastor or send him someplace else. And they, on their own, can decide whether or not they want to reveal his past. Now, in every 50 states, it's against the law not to report a minor. There should be no discussion among any church elders or church boards. You are to report to the authorities and the social services that you have had an incident of sexual abuse of a minor. It gets a little more complicated as these pastors start to abuse adult women. Again, a physician, it doesn't matter her age. If he has sex with his client, then, or his patient, then he loses his license. And so there are 13 states that now recognize that pastors are professionals. And if, regardless of the age, there is a crossing of the boundaries or inappropriate misconduct, they are no longer allowed to practice in their ministry. So 13 states are starting to begin to recognize, but it's not the churches that are doing this. It's state laws that are now saying we need to regulate church pastors as well if they're in this situation. I think the other problem we have with churches, and you know, the hierarchy is an issue because, like I said, my church could decide on its own how they wanted to handle it. But as we've seen in the Catholic Church, hierarchy doesn't always work either. The cover-ups continue because they're so afraid of what people will think of the church. Well, people understand that you can have a pastor and do all the background checks you can do, and someone can still slip in and commit sexual misconduct. Mm-hmm. The anger comes at the cover-up, not because you hired this man unknowingly, but that you then covered up what he did, and that still continues. So that's another problem with the church. So policing themselves is the problem, because you're asking this body of people to police someone that they care about, that they know, that they want to continue in the ministry. And that makes it very difficult then to do the right thing.
So then, in your opinion, what should be done, what can be done to correct this problem?
First of all, we need to talk about prevention. I highly encourage background checks, but be aware, background checks are very limited in what they will reveal. For instance, my abuser, when I confronted him, he's confessed that there have been many incidences over the years. They weren't all minors, but there were many incidents of sexual misconduct throughout the years. But he would pass a background check because there was no criminal activity involved, or it was ever alleged that there was any criminal activity. So he would pass a background check. So be aware that while they're a good thing to do, background checks should not be your only checks and balance. It's also important that you look into his background, check into his past histories of his employment. And again, churches don't do this because he comes with great credentials and he's a minister. Why would I want to look into his past? Of course, he's going to be a good person. So we need to look into their past. I'd also say that churches need strict policies on what they expect of their pastors. So when you hire a pastor or a rabbi or priest, it needs to be very clear that any misconduct results in removal. And so when you do that, the perpetrator who comes in looking for someone is going to be a little less likely to take that position, or he's going to be a little more careful in what he does. So you need to have a policy in place stating exactly what you expect from your pastors and what will the consequences be. If people who are interested in this, the Presbyterian Church has a very, very good policy on their website as to how they handle incidences of clergy misconduct. And it's been in place, I think, since 2002, maybe. So, but again, it's a policy that needs to be in place. But the policy is only as good as those who are willing to implement it. Now, that's prevention. Once a pastor has been found guilty of misconduct, he needs to be removed immediately. And it needs to be made clear to the congregation why he's removed. There's not going to be any question that, issues this, or we're not going to go into it because it's too personal. It needs to be clear of what he has done. There also needs to be a statement made that the victim will not be blamed, and she will only be named if she so chooses. You know, in my case, everybody knew who it was. I mean, there was no protection of me whatsoever. And then I would say that the church needs to maybe look for outside help to say, look, we need another pair of eyes on this and how we're going to handle this. Because what will also happen is you've got a grieving church as well, because they are now having to deal with learning that their pastor has committed sexual misconduct. And I think I read somewhere that it takes 3 to 5 years for a congregation to fully recover from a act of sexual misconduct by one of their spiritual leaders.
Wow. And do you think that, if it takes that amount of time, is there a mind shift or an attitude shift that people need to make? Like, do you feel as though people blame the victim? Would the congregation have looked at you as, it's your fault the pastor did this?
Right. I think there's a, because they want to see it as equal. Well, she participated too. And why should he take all the blame? So we need to understand again that churches see the moral fault. They understand that what he did was morally wrong. What they fail to see is the professional violation. He broke the ethics of his profession, and that needs to be handled differently. And churches are willing to forgive. They're willing to help. They use scriptures such as, we shouldn't judge another person. We're not judging his soul. We're judging his ability to do his job. And he's proven that he's not able to do that job by his own actions. So I do think there needs to be a shift. The other thing that we need to stop saying is he fell into sin or he had a moral fall. No, the term is he committed sexual misconduct or sexual abuse. We need to start using those terms because that defines exactly what he did. If we use terms like sin of the heart or moral fall, it sanitizes what he's done. And it tends to then make people respond to it differently. The words sexual misconduct and sexual abuse are pretty clear. And so those are I would like churches to start using those terms instead of moral fall. The other term I'd like to get rid of is to say that my pastor had an affair. He didn't have an affair, because an affair means you had mutual consent, that this person agreed to it. But if you educate yourself and understand the grooming and the manipulation and the control that this person had over this individual when she was in an emotional crippled state, she didn't have the tools to actually consent. And so it wasn't an affair. It was an abuse of his power, taking advantage of someone under his care.
Mm-hmm. Do you go to church now? Have you been able to make peace with what happened and go to church, or is church a hard place for you to go to?
Well, for 27 years when I was hiding this secret, I took my children to church, but I didn't connect to church at all. It was a very difficult time for me. Every time I passed the pastor's office, I got a knot in my stomach. It had nothing to do with that pastor. It was the fact that I could go back and remember those times I had sex in a pastor's office. And so, but that's what I did for 27 years. It was the way I learned to function. So I was always kind of had blinders on when I was in church. I didn't allow myself to become emotionally involved in church. After I was able to finally come forward with my story, church became a little bit easier, but there's still trigger factors for me. And now I understand why I feel that way, which is helpful. Before, I just knew I had these uneasy feelings and anxiety, and I just kind of kept stuffing it down. Well, now I deal with it. And so I think it's become a little bit easier. It will never be the same for me. It will never be the same. And I mourn that loss. I love church. It was such a wonderful place. But now it's a place of conflict for me. But I don't blame the church. I don't blame God. And so I'm able to go, but I make peace with it in my own way. Prayer is still difficult for me sometimes. I didn't pray for 27 years. I'm now able to pray. So I made progress, and progress, that's what I want to tell victims. There is hope and there is healing. You know, it takes a long, long time. And I still have setbacks where there are moments where I feel like I'm back in that time again, and the anxiety starts to build up in me. But I also know why, and so I can handle it a little bit better. I don't know that that'll ever always go away, but I understand it now. And it's been helpful to talk about my story because I'm not ashamed any longer. I can tell my story without shame. I didn't do anything wrong. I was in a place, as you said earlier, a place that should have been the safest place on earth for me. And it wasn't. I was devoured as I was a sheep. I was a lamb of God. And this wolf in sheep's clothing devoured me. And he took part of me away with me. And that is so, you know, I think I describe it best. And there's a chapter in my book called Spiritual Wounds. And I talk about those spiritual wounds and how I've lost a part of my spiritual life. But, you know, for 27 years, I didn't pray. I'm praying now. I've got a relationship with God, which I didn't have for 27 years. And so it's important for people to understand what clergy sexual abuse does to an individual spiritually. Some victims become atheists. They'll never believe in God again. Some of them become more spiritual because of the situation. You know, one woman said to me, you know, I just don't believe in God anymore. And I think she expected me to say, oh, you've got to believe in God and God is real. And I looked at her and I told her, I said, you know what? God knows what happened to you. And he's a big enough God to understand why you feel the way you do. And I believe that, you know, what was done to us was horrific. And it happened in the most sacred of all places. And it took a part of that sacredness away from us. And we need to be allowed that feeling and that mourning of that loss.
What do you want women to take away from your story? If there's one thing that could help someone who's been a victim of sexual abuse, what would it be?
The one thing I can't say enough, and I couldn't hear it enough either, was this was not your fault. And we have a lot of guilt as victims that, you know, I should have done this. I should have said this. I could have told someone. No, at the time, we did what we could with the coping skills that we had at the time. And we were sucked into this person's evilness and we didn't know how to get out. You know, just because there's a way out, doesn't mean we see that way out. And so I just stress to victims that it's not your fault. Don't blame yourself. All the responsibility and all the guilt and the shame lies squarely on your abuser. End of story. The second thing I say to victims is educate yourself. Learn all you can about clergy sexual abuse. You know, I think my book's a good resource, but there are lots of books out there that could be helpful. Marie Fortune, you can Google her. She's an excellent advocate in this area. Learn all you can, because once you begin to understand what was done to you, then you can free yourself from the guilt and the shame. And finally, I would say, if you haven't shared your abuse with anyone or told your story, find someone you can trust and tell them. And I say that knowing how hard it is, because I spent 27 years keeping that secret. So I understand how hard it is to tell someone, but as long as you keep that secret in, you're reliving that abuse. All that secret's doing is reminding you of your abuse. It's not allowing you to be free of it. And that's so important to let go of it, because the healing can only happen when you recognize that I'm no longer going to protect him and that I have nothing to be ashamed of.
There's so many more lessons. There's so much more to your story that's in your book that we can't cover today just sheerly because of time. But the book is it's a great one. It's one that you can't put down. If people want to read your story, want to connect with you more, how can they do that, Sandy?
Well, this is the book. The title's Let Me Pray Upon You. It's available on Amazon. It's also available on my website, which is my name, which is Sandy Phillips Kirkham. It's SandyPhillipsKirkham.com. And then my Gmail is also on that website, so they can contact me through my email as well. And I would encourage, again, there, you know, in the back of my book, there are several books, several websites. The Hope Survivors is a ministry that I work with. They have a great resource on their website. So just any information that you can find. And I would encourage people who've not been abused, who want to learn more about this, because until we educate the congregations and the synagogues, they're still going to get it wrong because they're not understanding what clergy, the dynamics of clergy sexual abuse and what really is going on. And so, you know, my platform is to help victims, but it's also to educate as well.
I will make sure that we take those links and we have them here in the show notes here for this episode specifically so people can learn more and get those resources. Sandy, thank you so much for sharing your story with us here today.
Well, I appreciate being here. You've been a great host.
Thank you for listening. And if you want to hear more Soul Source, just subscribe to our show. We're available wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can watch us too. We're on YouTube. Just look for Soul Source. Soul Source is brought to you by Red Shoes, Inc., a leading agency specializing in crisis and strategic communications, media relations, social media, and so much more. To learn more about Soul Source and Red Shoes, visit us at redshoesinc.com.